What we found, or what we documented, is that between June and October of this year, local groups affiliated to the South Sudanese Army on, or aligned with, rather, the South Sudanese Army on one hand and the armed opposition on the other, had waged what was essentially a campaign of terror upon the civilian population, namely the Balanda and Azande communities in Tembora County in western Equatorial State. According to our findings, this fighting was much more than intercommunal violence. So while politicians did whip up ethnic hatred and mobilize local youth to fight, and essentially the attacks involved local groups, but these local groups were also primarily affiliated or aligned with government and opposition forces.
You speak of violence whose scale and nature goes beyond intercommunal violence, which we see a lot of in South Sudan, and which is often driven by competition over resources. Tell our listeners a little bit of the background here. What caused all of this? Where did it start?
To the best of our knowledge, the recent violence in Western Equatorial State can be traced to the allocation of the state to the SPLM in opposition in May of 2020. This had come as part of a power-sharing agreement between parties to the 2018 peace deal. And so at the time of the allocation, shortly after the allocation of the state to the SPLM-IO, the first vice president, Riek Machar, subsequently appointed a governor, and it appears that that appointment had angered key figures in the political elite among the Azande community, who had historically governed Western Equatorial State. And therefore, we consider that the fighting is part of the ongoing armed conflict in South Sudan, because while, yes, it did involve local armed groups, they were aligned with the military on the one hand and the armed opposition forces on the other. The violence is essentially connected to competition over power sharing agreements, and contextually can be considered as an extension of the conflict that erupted in December 2013. They are not considered isolated acts of violence, and they must be viewed within the context of the wider conflict.
Your report says dozens of people were killed and more than 80,000 displaced from their homes, and atrocities were committed, even potential war crimes. Tell us what you were able to verify of these allegations.
So we spoke to 50 survivors, many of whom had witnessed firsthand a variety of human rights and international humanitarian law violations. Survivors told us of harrowing accounts of escaping indiscriminate gunfire that lasted for hours, and of entire neighborhoods being set alight. Many spoke of seeing their relatives or neighbors shot to death, fighters slitting people's throats. We also documented incidents where stray bullets landed in homes or IDP shelters, injuring civilians, including particularly a case of a 10-year-old girl who we documented her case. Hunger and inadequate shelter had also forced civilians out of their hiding place after they had run out. And even when they were coming out from hiding, they were still being captured and faced their death at the hands of fighters. One thing that really came across through our interviews was just the extent of the horrors that civilians witnessed. Bodies were set on fire and mutilated, or left to decompose for days without proper burial. Most of the people we interviewed also told us that their homes were looted or burned, that their crops were left unharvested. And satellite imagery did verify the extent of the widespread damage or destruction to the houses, as civilians had told us that had taken place between June and October across Tembora County. One thing to really note is the extent of the humanitarian crisis that is taking place at the moment across Tembora County. We're talking about 80,000 people who have been displaced. The vast majority of people we spoke to complained about their shelter conditions, whether they are in IDP camps or are living in host communities. Many of them spoke of extreme hunger, of their kids being out of school, of not being able to afford medication, let alone, of course, describing the horrific and traumatic exposures that they've been exposed to, and their need, their desperate need for humanitarian assistance, including psychosocial care.
Have you been in touch with the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the SPLA-IO regarding this report? And what recommendations do you have?
We did, as Amnesty International, meet and speak with some government officials, as well as members of, affiliated to the SPLA, SPLM-IO. Questions were posed to the South Sudan People's Defense Forces, but they went unanswered. What we are recommending is a series of steps. First of all, really, in order to address the humanitarian crisis, there needs to be a massive ramping up of humanitarian assistance to the displaced people. The government must absolutely facilitate that assistance, and humanitarian agencies should really consider increasing the assistance to the displaced population. The government must expedite the reconstruction efforts and ensure a safe and voluntary return. Absolutely has to be voluntary, of civilians should they feel that they are comfortable enough to return to their homes and to their towns. But of course, that is contingent on these reconstruction efforts, because many civilians told us that while in theory they would like to go back home, what would they be going back to with the mass destruction that had taken place? And of course, they do have still lingering security concerns because of the lingering presence of some fighters and of some of the politicians that were implicated in the violence. So reconstruction efforts and security efforts go hand in hand with the call for that safe and voluntary return. The government must also ensure that those who are responsible for the potential war crimes that we documented and the other violations that we documented are held to account.